It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
All right, once again, it is the It's Going Down podcast. This is a very important episode as we talk to three people facing charges from Disrupt J20, as well as somebody with the Tilted Scales Collective. These charges, described by lawyers as unprecedented, that have been thrown at almost 200 defendants, amount to life sentences and are an attempt to attack dissent and the anarchist movement in particular. As events have played out since January, we have learned that police have sexually assaulted arrestees, worked openly with alt-right media to dox people that have been arrested, and we have watched as the state has moved to gain access to vast amounts of private electronic data as an assault on basic freedoms. As a movement, we must and we will stand behind these comrades. Listen to this podcast for ways to get involved and to support people, support Dane, who has just gotten out, and be ready to go to D.C. if you can to support arrestees as they face trial starting on November 15th. Thanks a lot. We're going to get into it, talking about what's happened in the past several months, and be sure to watch itsgoingdown.org for more updates coming at you very soon about how you can plug in and support.
A lot has happened since Dane was sentenced back in July. It's really hard to kind of express like everything because it's a lot of back and forth between, you know, motions and responses to motions. But some of the major things that have happened were a request for data from the Disrupt J20 website. And this was a really broad overreach by the state that requested essentially like the personal identities of everyone who visited the website, which is just a website about protesting against Trump. And so that's sort of a really disconcerting signal that's being sent about dissent and about, you know, if you are even opposed to the president, then like you're in the eye of the state. Luckily, DreamHost stood up to them and fought back, and there has been a lot of back and forth. And unfortunately, they are still being allowed to collect the data, but some of it is redacted now, but it's still really a really broad overreach and is essentially a fishing expedition.
I think that one really important thing that happened was a gag order was a motion for a gag order was filed by the prosecution that was granted by the judge that initially prohibited any defendants sharing any discovered materials with the media. And that included body cam footage that was received from like FOIA requests from defendants. That includes evidence that's been turned over, and it basically it was a way of prohibiting any kind of exchange between defendants and the media to talk about sort of what's been going on. It was pretty restrictive at first. That's about it for that.
If I could just add to that, it's also important to note that this happened after some body cam footage was released to media, and then some articles that were critical of MPD's action that day came out. So it was essentially a direct response to that and to trying to avoid any criticism. And it's really at a pivotal time because there is a investigation of the police actions during the inauguration that's currently like being set up. Yeah, the OPC recommended that there be an investigation into the police actions that day and their use of force based on what they saw. And so we think that this is also, or at least I think that this is also a way to like prevent the public from knowing about the actions that the police took that way and therefore like hindering that investigation, which both like impacts our trials, but also I believe that several people are planning on filing or refiling lawsuits in addition to the ACLU lawsuit that's currently being ongoing against the state. So it's also an attempt to hinder that as well as the criminal trials and in order to protect themselves.
Yeah, and I think what's really interesting is like the arguments that the government was making about that protective order. They were essentially saying that the protective order or gag order that they wanted was to protect the privacy of police officers. But then on the other hand, they're filing all these subpoenas and search warrants for defendants' Facebook information. They're trying to subpoena all the records from this website that was used to coordinate over, dozens of different actions around the inauguration. And so on one hand, they're saying the privacy of these officers matters and the public doesn't need to know about what's on these body cam footage. But on the other hand, the government needs to know the private information, name, IP address, et cetera, of all these, I think it was up to like 6 million different unique visitors to disruptj20.org.
Yeah, and also the government like itself actually doxed us. And it like kind of somewhat recently came out that someone in the office essentially gave a PDF with all of our names and like basic info like age and hometown to a like well-known alt-right website, which was then like published. And definitely like defendants have definitely been directly harassed and threatened because of that. So
what was the also website? Kind of
Got News.
Oh, okay. So Got News is run by Charles C. Johnson. Friend of Richard Spencer, also runs the WeSearcher crowdfunding campaign site. They raised over $1 million for the Daily Stormer. But thank you for sharing that. I mean, that's insane. It's not surprising, but it's crazy. And I mean, going back to the DisruptJ20 website, how is there a precedent for that? I mean, the government literally saying, if you look at a website, you know, we think that you're a suspect, or like, I mean, why do they even want that information? Like, what does that actually have to do with the case? Like, what are they going to use with that information to then say, like, you know, there's a conspiracy to break windows with all these people that we kettled?
I mean, I think it's just indicative of the state's entire character in the case so far, like extending all the way back even to the arrest itself. The arrest itself was just this dragnet of every body that was present on the corner of L and 12th Street. And, you know, they don't have any kind of way to legitimize what was essentially an illegal arrest. So because they threw themselves into this corner where they have to kind of defend themselves for basically corralling a mass of people into a corner and then arresting them, they're doing the exact same thing all over again. Now they're trying to make this enormous reach for as much information as they can possibly get on literally any person who came to this website to find out what kind of protests would be happening in DC. Because people forget that there were actually very many forms of demonstration and resistance that took place in DC that day. And they want to use this information to see if they can somehow piece together something that will corroborate this conspiracy charge that they're leveling against the 200 people that they've arrested.
I think it's also important to note, like, with the kind of search warrant, like subpoena against DreamHost, like for all the like IP addresses and whatnot, like, so DreamHost being the web host for disruptj20.org, like when that company DreamHost first challenged it, the prosecution really scaled or kind of like backpedaled and said that they had accidentally been overly broad in their filing, like to try to get all the information. And so then they were kind of narrowing things down to what they said was like pertinent to their investigation. Clearly though, like what's actually happening was that they were trying to like do that fishing expedition and get as much information as possible, which is designed to, like to benefit them as far as like their databases and all that sort of thing, but also send this super chilling message to anybody who was looked at the website, anybody who could possibly think about looking at another website in the future to resist Trump and like to dissent and to be out in the streets and like organizing resistance. And so that's like, it's all part of this broader part or broader strategy of like state repression of dissent to make sure that people are getting this message loud and clear that any kind of resistance, any kind of organizing will be brutally repressed, like not only under this administration, which is has been manifestly clear like since January 20th, but also like in general in the United States.
There's a new Department of Justice U.S. attorney on the case, part of the Trump transition team. What does this mean for the case itself?
I mean, it's hard to say. The only thing I know about the former U.S. attorney was that, and that's Channing Phillips. The only thing I know about the former U.S. attorney was that he was an Obama appointee and was active last year around the time when Terrence Sterling was killed by the Metropolitan Police Department. And I think also like the DOJ investigation this summer found insufficient evidence to charge the officer who killed Terrence. So I know he oversaw that. In terms of the case, since he's not a Trump appointee and wasn't really a part of the Trump transition team, he maybe was acting as sort of a stopgap between Attorney General Sessions and this case, maybe pushing back on some of the methods that Sessions wanted to employ. But now we have the new U.S. Attorney, Liu, who was a part of the Trump transition team, is a Trump appointee, and maybe is no longer going to act as a stopgap between Sessions and this case. So maybe we'll see some new tactics being employed in this case, or there'll be some shuffling of resources from other cases to this case. It's really hard to say, but either way, I don't think this is a positive change for the 190 remaining defendants and people who have already taken plea deals.
I'll just say that it's like pretty unsurprising that basically all of the, you know, like the prosecutor, Jen Kirchhoff, is a conservative. Obviously, this new attorney is also a conservative since they were part of the Trump transition team. And I just can't help but wonder if it wasn't someone who ideologically aligned with Trump, like would these charges still be going forward? You know, would this amount of information be requested, you know? And I think those are important questions to bear in mind.
Well, let's turn to how people have been supporting you. Can we just talk a little bit about the organizing that's been going into people supporting J20 defendants? And also just, I mean, what do you all think? I mean, there's been a lot written recently about how, you know, quote unquote, hashtag the resistance and mainstream liberals have kind of thrown J20 defendants under the bus. But how are people stepping up for you? And how do you think that this can continue in the future with the court cases coming up?
Well, to the first part of your question, how have people continued to support defendants? Right now, the main priority as we've moved a bit closer to the trial dates, which begin in about 3 weeks, attention has been shifted to making sure that those defendants who are going to be in D.C. for an extended period of time, the trials are estimated to last anywhere from like 2 to 3 weeks, that they have everything that they need logistically to go through that process. Trials, much like arrests and incarceration, are a traumatic experience, and they're going to need emotional support from each other and from all of their other community members. So we've just been making sure that they have their food needs taken care of, their transportation costs taken care of, their housing situation taken care of, making sure that there's a group of dedicated note takers that are there in court to record everything that's been happening. Jude can speak a little bit more about that effort, though. They've been pretty instrumental with that.
Yeah, so there are a lot of different things in the works, like to provide support for defendants like under trial. The trials right now, it seems like the prosecution and the judge expect them to last like 2 or 3 weeks. There's a very good chance like that they could also last much longer. Like in a recent court hearing, the prosecutor mentioned that she expected to bring in 25 or maybe 27 to 40 witnesses against the defendants who are going to trial starting on November 15th. And even if they only ask a very small number of cursory questions for each witness, you can imagine like how long like that whole process would take. So it's a very uncertain period of time that the defense would actually be under trial. And during that time, there's a lot of different like groups that have been organizing kind of interconnected ways, but also like with a high degree of like coordination in order to provide a range of supports, including court notes, like as was just mentioned. And those court notes are going to be like very useful in various ways, just kind of keeping track of like what is happening day by day in trial, because that can get very confusing. There'll also be a range of things being provided to the defendants to help them like weather all the ordeals, all the stress. And for a lot of people, like the kind of like triggering of trauma and like re-traumatization by going through like everything that happened on that particular day, because the kettle and the arrests were such like a terrible experience for so many, like hundreds of people. So with that in mind, there will be things like emotional care and like herbal care, tinctures and like different things to help people kind of get through all of that. There'll also be things like fun social activities and food being provided for defendants at different times. So a very wide like swath of things in order to help like our comrades like go through these like really terrible situations. The trials that have so much at stake and so much on the line for them.
Is there a plan for any sort of demonstration or pressure campaigns like in that time, or is it mostly devoted towards providing support for people during when the trial starts?
I haven't heard of any demos being organized at the moment, but I'm certain that there are folks on the ground who will likely be putting something like that together, or at least I hope that they will. Right now, as defendants, we are just trying to make sure that our other co-defendants are supported with everything that they're going to need to get through those 3 weeks, because they're going to be a very difficult 3 weeks, I think.
Right.
But one of the, I think, best things that they've come up with, which I hope other defendants model with their trial groups, is that they are going to be sharing housing together during the trials. I think that's going to be very, very important, because as defendants, at least in my experience, I've found that when we come together, when we share space together, when we provide that support to one another, that's really one of the most positive things that's come out of this experience so far. And it's been one of the most helpful things to get through this experience so far. So hopefully other defendants can use that going forward with their own trial groups, because it's going to be hopefully one of the things that carries people forward.
I just want to add one thing. I know it's not like a in the streets demonstration, but I've heard there are plans for lots of people who are generally supportive of this case, or of these defendants in this case, are planning to come to DC, sit in court, and just be there as a physical sign of solidarity. And I think that's like, that demonstrates the strength that we have collectively. And it may not be out in the streets, but I think in the courtroom it's just as important.
Right. Well, I think anything that shows that there's a massive amount of support, and obviously like too, just we know what the government's doing with this. I mean, they're trying to clamp down on dissent, they're trying to clamp down on resistance, and you know, make examples out of people, and you know, we're not going to allow that to fly.
I'm always in a. So when you see me in the street, I'm always in a. you know, I remember a couple months ago, people were saying how hard it was to even get the media, even places like The Nation or something, to talk about the, you know, the upcoming trials and the fact that some people are facing upwards of like 75 to 80 years in prison. How do you think the media has changed and in their covering of the case, and how has this either helped or maybe not done anything?
Initially, there was very minimal coverage, and like a lot of the coverage just wasn't really great. Like it pulled almost directly from like what the government was trying to say for their case, essentially, and like didn't bother to, you know, look at any of the footage of the day or like really to, like talk to people and try and understand like the situation and like how intense the case actually is. So initially, there was very little. But thankfully, like through time and through a lot of like outreach and communication with people, the story is finally starting to be picked up. I think a lot of that also has to do with just in some ways, the state is just being increasingly overt with their like concerning behavior, you know, like the request for the IP addresses and other data for visitors to the Disrupt J20 website got a lot of attention because it is a really broad overreach. And so the state has sort of continuously been more and more, I guess, bold and has been doing, you know, increasingly questionable things. Or as like the case goes on, the state keeps doing questionable things and making these really broad overreaches and essentially fishing expeditions, which I think has alarmed a lot of people, and rightfully so. And because of that, the media, I think, has sort of reinvested time into the case. And then because of that, they're finally starting to, you know, have a more honest perspective and representation of it rather than just pulling directly from, you know, the prosecution's like press release or something like that.
I think there's also been increased media recently because there are still two journalists who are being charged in this case. So I think that one of those journalists is going to trial in 3 weeks' time. And I think that lots of organizations around freedom of the press and different types of nonprofits who are involved in reporting on infringements of freedom in the press have started making noise. And so more media outlets have been kind of picking up that angle. And then we've also seen some new pieces from more mainstream outlets, like the Daily Beast had a piece a couple weeks ago that basically outlined how a good portion of the video evidence in the government's case comes from alt-right, far-right YouTube personalities who essentially took chopped and screwed video from the day and made these really dramatic audio overlays. So that was an interesting piece. And then other outlets like The Real News, they've been doing, they're not an outlet I was familiar with before this, but they've been doing a lot of really good coverage. And one really great thing they did was, it was either a week ago or 2 weeks ago, they published FOIA requests that they made from the Metropolitan Police Department on their, like how much or what weapons they deployed and how much they used. And it came back with a really staggering number that something like 74 Sting ball grenades were deployed that day. Several MK-46, which are like the huge fire extinguisher pepper spray canisters, were returned empty. It's just like that kind of reporting wasn't really there at the beginning back in January or February, but now there are like way more media outlets that I think are starting to pick up this case.
What moves has the U.S. government made towards getting more information about people that have interacted with Disrupt J20, the website? And what are they trying to get out of these data grabs? I know we talked a little bit about that earlier in this conversation, but I want to go back to it. If they succeed, especially, what will this mean in the future? I mean, will this be the precedent that they will then go and try to basically create a digital map of who is even looking at these websites?
I was just going to say that I think it's really important to remember that this regime is all about setting precedents.
Uh-huh.
Right? They like even beginning with this case and with things like the Muslim ban, which happened just a few weeks after our mass arrest, like this regime is really trying to see like how far it can absolutely get with whatever it wants to try and do. And after, like, with some of the protests that happened in St. Louis after the Jason Stokely verdict came through, we saw even more kettling happening during those demonstrations. So I think that what happens with this case is really going to set the tone for the next 4 years. That's gonna that comes into play with this data grab, because if they can get away with trying to do this dragnet search, what they want to do is see how many connections they can build between people, how completely they can map out any kind of demographic of resistance to Trump's administration and to the state. So if they are allowed to get away with this and allowed to use it for forcing through convictions, I think that could have just the same level of chilling effect on dissent in the future as the mass arrest itself.
I think another important implication to kind of recognize or draw from the prosecution's attempts, like very, you know, overreaching, heavy-handed attempts to like gather all this electronic information from this web host, is that anytime people are trying to organize, you know, any kind of resistance and kind of like opposition, public like protests or whatever, it actually, like, if especially if this prosecution is successful, but even if it's not, if other prosecutors like try to like make this successful in different jurisdictions, it really is advantageous for anybody who's doing any level of public protest to think very carefully about like what kind of web presence are you having, are IP addresses being stored, how are things being tracked. Like what with like in the past, like when people have been thinking about, like, oh, we're going to do this protest, or we're going to respond to this thing, or we're going to do this, or we're going to do that, and creating, you know, free websites or open up a social media handle or like whatever has been a very easily accessible thing that a lot of people haven't thought about. But this prosecution is showing that there could potentially be like criminal charges that could result from doing these things that people have for, you know, years and years been thinking as like kind of like no brainers as far as like organizing protests and resistance and whatnot. So if anything, people should be thinking much more defensively about like how are we organizing. And that's not to say that we shouldn't be organizing public demonstrations and like using tools such as the internet in order to reach out to like comrades, like like-minded people. But we have to understand the enemy that we're facing. This enemy, if other prosecutors in other jurisdictions like try to go the same route, like, it's really to our benefit in order to think about like how are we controlling the electronic foot trails. That's not the right word.
Footprint.
Footprints. Yes, footprints that are being left.
I know about the foot trails, though.
Yes. It's also complicated. It's also complicated, like all the time. But we have to be thinking very much like the way that our enemies are thinking about repressing us in order to like prevent or combat that repression and be able to do the, like the organizing that we need to do based on like all the things that we're seeing that we absolutely have to respond to and we have to contest and fight back against.
Yeah, Jude, those are excellent points. Like, I feel like this should hammer home for a lot of people how important security culture is and how important it is to be mindful of like what traces you are leaving when you interact with the internet. One thing that I'm kind of worried about is, I mean, obviously I'm worried about all the defendants whose information is being sought by the government, but what about the people who were not necessarily even at a protest or even in DC that day? And now the government has all this information on you. Like, how are they going to use that? How are they going to what extent does that lead to targeting people and preemptively shutting down potential moments of resistance? I think to me, that's another scary aspect of this, is that with all this information, there's no good way to know what the government plans to use with the information that's not pertinent to the case.
So for people listening right now, the trial is going to happen. The trials are going to start happening soon. I mean, what do you want people that are listening to this to know about how they should support people that are going up against these huge, huge trumped up charges. I mean, like, what are the things that you want people after they, you know, put their phone down or shut off their computer after listening to know, like, what they should do to support J20 defendants, like tangible things?
I think first and foremost is to get informed. I think a lot of people still don't really know about the case or know like specific details from it. And hopefully, you know, we've provided some details through this, but really there's a lot more to it. So people should go to our website, which is defendj20resistance.org. And there you can read all sorts of media about the case, and you can also go to our support page, which has different ways for people to get involved in support, whether that be through you know, helping organize with us and like set up support in DC through the trials, or whether that be, you know, if you can afford to donate anything. We also have a statement of solidarity that people and organizations can sign on to. And we have different campaigns like the Drop the Charges campaigns and some petitions that people can sign. So there are plenty of ways for people to get involved no matter what your capacity is. And I think it's really, really important that people do this because, as was said earlier, this is a precedent-setting case that is going to determine how people are able to resist Trump and the government and the bigotry and violence that they bring in the future years. And if you, you know, we're not even 1 year into the presidency yet, you know, like this is just the beginning and it's only going to get worse. And so we're going to need to have each other's backs starting now to make sure that we can, you know, continue to support and defend each other from this regime and, you know, help each other make it through this. So I definitely encourage everyone to get involved in any capacity that you can manage. You know, there's a spot for everyone, and we need it and definitely appreciate it.
Yeah, I think another thing people can do if they're in like big cities in the US is try and find out if your region has a like a local support network for J20 defendants. And if there is, plug into that and see how you can help. Something as little as, you know, pet sitting while someone goes to a hearing, or maybe even driving a defendant to DC if that's feasible. Like all those forms of support are really, really, really helpful and really appreciated. Another thing people can do, like if you can't donate financially, maybe try setting up some sort of benefit or fundraiser. There have been some good examples of things folks have done to like show solidarity and also raise funds to help cover legal costs. Like there was a benefit comedy show that I heard was really fun. There've been some fundraising punk shows and even like a silent auction of arts and crafts. So stuff like that, just like fun activities where defendants can kind of have fun, and also it can help raise money so that people are not strapped with a bunch of debt from legal costs, housing costs, transportation costs, etc. All of that can be really helpful and appreciated.
I think that one really important but very simple thing that people can do is to just talk to other people about this case. Something that's been really surprising has been just the way that people, at least in my community and my neighbors around me, they do not know that this case is going on. For all of the really good media that has happened so far, we are still undergoing something of a blackout, and a lot of folks don't know that 200 people got killed. So if you are a supporter and you're following this case, go like tell three people who don't know that this is happening that it's happening, and then go tell them to talk to other people too. You know, get on social media and share articles and your thoughts about what's going on. Just try to tell as many people as you can and make this case as visible as possible. Because the more visible it becomes, the more pressure there will be on the state to play by their own rules. When no one is watching, the state can move the goalpost and they can change their rules. But when people are paying attention, they have to play by the book. So far, they haven't, but that can happen if people start to watch what's going on. Another thing that defendants definitely need support with is lawyers. We continue to need movement lawyers that can build the kind of defense that, you know, our co-defendants feel good about and that support them legally, but then also support their own personal ethics and their politics. So if there are any lawyers out there who are listening right now, or folks who know of lawyers that are supportive, please tell them to get in touch with folks, get in touch with defendants, get in touch with Dead City Legal Posse, who can put them in touch with other defendants so that we can get more legal support on the case.
And when people are like wanting to talk with like, you know, friends or neighbors or whatever about the case, there are some really good resources that people can draw on. So going to like our support website, defendj20resistance.org, is a really good place to find some of those. There are also things like, you know, this really amazing podcast interview, and Submedia put out an episode of Trouble a few months back that like talked about the J20 case a lot. And so people could like do a screening of that, or, you know, sit around together, like listen to this episode, and, you know, you kind of discuss things afterwards. There's also things like if people are kind of wanting to just keep track of like what is happening kind of day by day in the case, on both Twitter and Instagram, people can follow at defendj20. And that's like a good way of kind of seeing like all the latest happenings. Also, if they go to defendj20resistance.org, you can sign up for a newsletter that will come out periodically with like big updates on the case and like information about how to get plugged in for support. I think it's also really important to note that one of the defendants in this case, Dane Powell, took a non-cooperating plea agreement to two felony counts. This was over the summer, and he's actually scheduled to get released on Halloween, October 31st. And there is a fundraiser that has been launched in order to help him kind of get his life back in order, like once he gets released like from federal prison. Right. And if they go to defendj20resistance.org and click on the blog link, you'll see the posts about Dane's like release and how to support, and including a fundraising link so that people can help him like have the finances that he will need to get his life set up again.
And speaking about Dane for the next question, his case in particular, does that seem like that's going to be the bar for a lot of people? Because, I mean, I think a lot of people think, like, how the fuck can people be facing 80 years in prison? And then I think when Dane was sentenced to a couple months, like, do you think that that's what a lot of people will be facing? Or I'm just curious, like, based on everything that you all have seen from what the state is doing, how does Dane's case kind of fit into that?
I think there's a couple things that we should note, which is, you know, first off, like when Dane took the plea, Dane had like fewer charges than he would have than that the defendants have now. So that means like basically the potential time that he could have done was lower than what we can do now. So if, you know, like they don't have a strong case against anyone, it seems. So, you know, I'm feeling pretty positive about our case, but I also don't have a lot of faith in the justice system for obvious reasons, especially when it's, you know, being run by all conservative people and in this regime where, you know, the courts have done very little to stop Trump. Yeah, that's one element. And then I think also, and this was something that was discussed, like when the plea was being considered, is that there was sort of the thought that maybe the prosecution would go easier for this one in order to like encourage more people to plea out. Yeah, basically, this is all really long form way of saying that I don't think anyone will do any serious time, but I do think that there is potential for people to do a lot of time, and definitely for people to do more time than Dane. And Dane only, I shouldn't say only, but Dane had 4 months in jail, but he still has he still has a long time to be on probation, which is just another form of imprisonment. So we should also note that too. So for anybody who's convicted of the felony charges, it very easily could be, you know, years. And also your record factors into it as well. So people who are career activists and who may have been, you know, arrested and charged and maybe even convicted of activism before are like definitely more at risk for this, which is sort of like quantified repression against those who repeatedly like resist, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know how good of a bar Dane's sentencing is. Throughout that sentencing hearing, the judge and the government both said that they were going easy on him, which doesn't make any sense, but they said they were going easy on him because he just, I guess in their words, took responsibility and took responsibility early. That was like a major thing that I believe the judge kept saying, was that he was doing this early. So it seems like the state really wanted to reward people who took pleas as a way to not go to trial, to prevent all these resources from being used for trial. And so they were rewarding people who took those pleas with shorter sentences and maybe less stringent release conditions. So for folks going to trial, I don't think anyone who does get convicted can expect the same leniency. And the government and the judge both made that pretty clear.
To build off of that, I think one important thing to remember, or maybe like to realize about the criminal legal system in the United States, is that convictions are not the same as guilt, right? Like there are like rampant number of like situations, like cases, like where people are put in situations like where they plead guilty to different actions or different like so-called like crimes because of how that system works. And there's also plenty of times like when people go to trial and get convicted by juries, and then maybe years down the line, for in a lot of cases, those cases like are overturned and those convictions are thrown out. Which is not to say that's like what happened like all the time, but that is something that happens. And so some of these defendants in this particular case like may very well go to trial and be convicted by juries, and then years down the line that could be like overturned. And we hope that nothing like that like ever happens like to any of these defendants who are involved in this case, like those folks who we're supporting. But when people are looking at that, there's those two basic and very important things to remember. One is that actual like responsibility for actions that people like engage in or did not engage in is not the same as like the verdict that is reached through the criminal legal process, including like trials like by juries. And that when you look at things like those different statements that the judge might make about like people taking responsibility for the action and like therefore getting leniency, that's part of the oppressive apparatus of the criminal legal system, and that's part of how it's designed to like force about 95% of cases across the board like in the US to be resolved through plea agreements and not going to trial and not accessing all these rights that the government supposedly gives us. So when people are looking at the results of the criminal legal process, like how that is part of state repression and needs to be like kept in mind. And when people are supporting people who have, you know, pled guilty or being convicted at trial, like understanding that support as being resistance to this like repressive apparatus is like very much at the heart of it, very much at the center of like what supporting people means. And I think it is like very important to voice, and I'm glad that Oh voiced this, that it's not done like once somebody is released from prison. There's probation, and most of the people who are facing or serving time are there like for probation violations or like parole violations. And oftentimes people who get wrapped up in that part of the system end up spending more time on the alleged violations than they did for their original sentences. And that's another part of how the criminal legal system in the prison industrial complex like work in order to keep such a carceral state and like mass incarceration.
Well, you know, the next question I just wanted to ask broadly, if people can just paint a picture, I think people really need to understand that, I mean, basically what the state is trying to argue is that there was a conspiracy to engage in criminal activity, and the conspiracy is based on wearing the same clothing, chanting slogans, you know, looking at a website. And really, when you boil it down, if you look at like what happened, I mean, there was like what, 7 windows that were broken that day. I mean, the burning of the limo happened after the kettle, from my understanding. I'm just curious if people could basically lay out for listeners essentially what the state is trying to argue and also why that's just bullshit.
Basically, the state is saying that, I mean, in its most basic form, they're are basically just trying to criminalize, like, protesting, you know, like, various people from all different, you know, like, walks of life and, like, beliefs and stuff were there in D.C. standing up against Trump. And so, like, our common ground really is, like, our resistance to Trump, and that's what they're targeting us for. Basically, they're saying, you know, it's, like, they don't really care about the windows or, like, you know, whatever allegedly happened. It's not the specifics of, like, the event that upsets them. It's the fact that we were there at all. Like, you know, I'd be willing to bet that even if, like, those things weren't, like, you know, if those things didn't happen, there, you know, probably still would have been arrests. Yeah, basically, you know, if you go to a website against, you know, the leader, the president, you know, the person that they support, you know, the person this U.S. attorney literally helped, like, transition, then you're, in their view, guilty. And so it just shows you how they're trying to, like, say that being against someone and being opposed to, like, the bigotry of Trump is conspiracy.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's really scary that they're basically saying if you're in the same area and you are exercising your First Amendment protected rights to speech and expression and also assembly, that if someone who you may have never met, never associated yourself with, just happens to be wearing similar clothing to you, does something that the state doesn't like, that then you're somehow culpable. That to me is the scary part. And like the example I like to use to paint this picture to like friends and family that I'm introducing to this case is that, you know, at sports games, there's often scuffles in the crowds, and people go to these sports games. They send texts, they send emails, they buy tickets, they do all this planning online. They often wear the same stuff to these games, like jerseys or whatever. And then if someone wearing, let's say a Redskins jersey punches someone wearing another team's jersey at the stadium, it's not that every single person in the stadium wearing a Redskins jersey is now going to be tear gassed, maced, have grenades thrown at them, kettled and arrested and charged with 8 felonies to face 75 years. Like, that doesn't happen. But the same thing happens on the streets of D.C. during the inauguration during First Amendment protected activities. And all of a sudden, over 200 people are facing these ridiculous charges and essentially life sentences. So to me, that's kind of like the theory of the government, is that if you're there and you're wearing something similar and you happen to have maybe communication about it beforehand, you're guilty by association. But they're not applying that to other groups. And what we saw, unfortunately, in Charlottesville was kind of similar in a way, where there were groups who made plans to be there and even made very explicit plans online to be violent, as we've seen through some of the leaks of their Discord chats. They wore the same thing, they brought weapons, but they're not all being penalized by the state. And maybe it's because they support the person that is sitting in the Oval Office right now.
So, I mean, like in one of the latest Discord chats that's been leaked by Unicorn Riot, they're literally talking about blowing up a federal building. I mean, if IGD did that, there'd be somebody kicking down our door within 5 minutes. And these people can just throw it out there like they're talking about where they're going to go eat that night. It's crazy.
And I mean, someone was trying to blow up a federal building, or not a federal building, but was trying to blow up a building in Oklahoma a month ago, and they were thwarted by the FBI. Thankfully, no one was hurt. And like they're, I think the maximum jail time they could be facing is 30 years. Uh-huh. And people in this case are looking at 75 plus,
right,
for 6 or 7 broken windows. It's just, it makes no sense.
Yeah, there was a case that we wrote about a couple months ago. It was a guy that was in the military, and I think they rejected him for some promotion because of some like asinine reason. And he went back and like tried to burn down the building. He got like, I think like 5 years or something like that. And it's just like, you can literally like have a mask on walking down the street and you're facing 80 years in prison.
Well, I just think that kind of speaks to what the state sees as a threat. It sees people organizing and saying like, we're not going to stand for this. We're going to stand up for what we believe in. That's a threat to a state. People organizing to like blow up one building or whatever, they maybe don't see that as a threat.
I think that to piggyback on that, it's just really important to remember that the state is not a neutral actor. The state is not an objective or an unbiased actor, and they have, over the last 10 months, shown time and time again, whether it's in Portland, whether it's in Charlottesville, whether it's in Charlottesville again, when, you know, Richard Spencer shows up twice with his flash mob of Nazis, they are willing to openly cooperate with these fascist and far right formations. The state has no problem doing this. And they do that because, you know, these formations help the state achieve its goal, which is to maintain white supremacy, which is to maintain patriarchy, which is to maintain colonization. You know, they are not going to throw these conspiracy charges at far right groups. We shouldn't expect them to do that. And we shouldn't be asking them to do that, because when they throw it to the right, they're eventually going to be throwing more of them at us. You know, whatever the state gets away with doing to the far right, it looks really great at the first second that it's happening. But then they turn right back around and they do that to our movements. You know, and with these conspiracy charges, I think it's really important to see them for what they are, which is the state trying to find a way to criminalize us for acting in solidarity with each other, when, you know, whatever the case may be. And the historical example that always stands out to me the most is the Underground Railroad. You know, the Underground Railroad, like, is one of the most amazing, incredible demonstrations of mutual aid, maybe in recent human history. It was a group of people risking their lives to try and escape people out of literal plantation slavery. And, you know, we as the people see that as this incredible act of humanity. But in the state's eyes, they saw those folks as a, you know, a conspiracy and as a criminal network of would-be felons. So the state isn't interested in our humanity. It's interested in maintaining a very specific social order. And these conspiracy charges are just one way of them being able to say, hey, you're a community of people who are taking care of each other, doing what you need to do. So we're going to criminalize you all at once, and we're going to throw you in a cage. And the more that they can get away with it now during this extremely repressive regime, the farther they'll take it until, you know, there's no one left to resist, ultimately.
You know, we've covered a lot of ground, talked about how people can support. Is there anything else you want to say? Any other closing thoughts that you want people to know listening to this?
My closing thoughts would be that this is a really important case for everyone involved, for the defendants, for the supporters, for their families. But it's also a really important case for what the next 4-8 years are going to look like. And so maybe right now you don't think of yourself as someone who wants to take it to the streets to voice your political opinion, but that could change. And you don't want to wake up in 5 years and be repressed the way that these folks are being repressed, when you could have taken a stand right now. And the biggest way to take a stand is to spread the word about this and be supportive of the case and make sure that the government doesn't get what it wants by criminalizing dissent.
Final thoughts for me, I guess, would be just as we come closer to the trials, for our supporters out there, make sure you have your eyes on the case and watch carefully as this goes on. You know, they will try to get away with as much funny business as they can while the case is happening. So keep your eyes on the game and do as much as you can to support the folks who are going to be going through this in November.
And just like a final, I think, to add, you know, I think that all the different things that the prosecution has been trying in this case, like from charging 230 people at the outset, and then, you know, with superseding indictments to add additional charges. So now there's like still over 190 people who are facing all these charges. And then all the things with like Facebook subpoenas for data and the search warrant like for the web host and all that, like they're putting it out very clearly that they're trying to make this such a broad sweeping investigation so that anybody who is at all associated or at all interested in the protests and kind of dissent against Trump, anyone who might possibly be in the future trying to scare them away from doing that. So really supporting these defendants is an act of community self-defense and movement self-defense. And we have to be constantly considering it in those terms and knowing that standing in solidarity with these defendants is also protecting all of us against this type of state repression. So I think going to defendj20resistance.org, if you use social media, you know, Twitter and Instagram, following at defendj20 is a really good way of figuring out how to plug in, how to be in solidarity, how to be in support, and therefore, like, ultimately how to protect all of us in, across, like, the so-called country throughout the rest of this regime, and then also, like, throughout, like, in the future as we continue to organize and continue to resist.
My bills don't wait. Mommy's angry. Club is old and I am bored too late. Vicious city tried to break me, but I walk right through. I couldn't care less. No, I'm fearless. On my way to you. Out there now is full on confusion and madness, but I don't care. No, I don't care. Hear them and on the radio keep crying, but I don't care. No, I don't care. Politicians keep lying, we keep on dying. There is always a war. Pollution keep pumping, people keep jumping, but I never been in love before. Population keep growing, bombs keep on blowing, and we always want more. Hearts keep on breaking, souls keep on aching, but and madness, but I don't care. No, I don't care. Can hear them and on the radio keep crying, but I don't care. No, I don't care. Politicians keep lying, we keep on dying. There is always a war. Pollution keep pumping, people keep jumping, but I never been in love before. Population keep growing, bombs keep on blowing, and we always want more. Politicians keep lying, we keep on dying. There is always a war. Pollution keep pumping, people keep jumping, but I've never been in love before.